Now, press watch.
You're listening to KVOO Portland. This is Press Watch, Left Opinion and Counter Propaganda. And I'm Teresa Mitchell with the news you're not supposed to know. In a few moments, I'll be joined live by Paul Zaremka, author of the compilation Hidden History of 9/11. And we will be talking about the ever-focusing picture emerging of the false flag attack that occurred more than 7 years ago now. First, these four news items that are currently de-emphasized or buried in the corporate news media. Cy Hirsch has blown the cover on the Cheney Bush dictatorship's death squads. Quote, after 9/11, I haven't written about this yet, but the Central Intelligence Agency was very deeply involved in domestic activities against people they thought to be enemies of the state, without any legal authority for it. They haven't been called on this, end quote. That's journalist and author Seymour Hirsch speaking at the University of Minnesota earlier this week. According to Minnesota Public Radio, Alternet and Raw Story, Hirsch then talked about another rogue group, the Joint Special Operations Command. Quote, it is a special wing of our special operations community that is set up independently. They do not report to anybody except in the Bush-Cheney days they reported directly to the Cheney office. Congress has no oversight of it, end quote. Also quoting, it's an executive assassination ring, essentially, and it's been going on and on. Hirsch stated under Bush's authority, also quoting, they've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving. That's been going on in the name of all of us, in quotes. Item number two. It is becoming apparent that global warming caused rising sea levels pose a far greater danger to the planet than previously estimated. The most recent scientific consensus in 2007 from the International Panel on Climate Change concluded that sea level rises of between 20 and 60 centimeters would occur by 2100. However, this estimate contained very little input from melting ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. The latest revised science suggests climate change caused by sea level rise could easily reach 1 to 2 meters by 2100. There's now a major risk that many coastal areas around the world will be inundated by the end of the century because Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets are melting faster than previously estimated. And departing from that text, that is from climatearc.org. And they write, it will not stop then, as by 2200, a rise of 1.5 to 3.5 meters will occur unless warming is stopped. Rising oceans will contaminate freshwater supplies, wipe out coastal farmland, and lead to increased storms with massive ocean surges. Now, departing from that text, please don't be comforted by the idea that this will take place 100 years from now. Everything that I've been finding and passing on this program has indicated that there's an acceleration in the acceleration of the phenomenon of global warming. Here's further information from Mark Linus from his book, 6 Degrees, also posted on climatearc.org, that's A-R-K. He writes, if we cross the tipping point of Amazonian collapse and soil carbon release that lies somewhere above 2 degrees, then another 250 parts per million of CO2 would pour into the atmosphere, yielding another 1.5 centigrade of warming and taking us straight into the 4-degree world. Once we arrive there, the accelerated release of carbon and methane from thawing Siberian permafrost will send even more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, driving yet more warming and perhaps pushing us on into the 5-degree world. At that level of warming, organic methane hydrate release, the clathrates, become a serious possibility, catapulting us into the ultimate mass extinction apocalypse of 6 degrees. The lesson is clear as it is daunting. If we are to be confident about saving humanity and the planet from the worst mass extinction of all time, worse even than that at the end of the Permian, we must stop at 2 degrees. So find that at climatearc.org. And as I said, after a couple of more news items, we are about to have an interview with Paul Zaremka. Stay tuned for that, the hidden history of 9/11. Dollars and Cents writes that congressional investigators have discovered that some of the largest banks receiving U.S. taxpayer bailout funds have been lending billions of dollars overseas. Among the findings, Citigroup A recipient of $45 billion in bailout funds, lent $8 billion to investors in Dubai. And Bank of America, which got another $45 billion, lent $7 billion for a project in China. The investigators found that the Treasury had few controls for tracking the bailout money for the 20 largest banks and no controls at all for the other 297 smaller banks. News you're not supposed to know, item number four. The Whopper isn't dead. This is from Portland Indy Media, posted by Relay. The BLM's massive Western Oregon plan revision, logging plan, or Whopper, has ignited a groundswell of opposition. Skipping ahead in the article, as it stands today, the Whopper is the law of the land for 2.5 million acres of forest in Western Oregon. And the BLM is taking steps to implement the plan on the ground. The first major project under the Whopper is just announced, and it is a 1,400-acre clear cut above salmon-bearing streams in Oregon's Coast Range called Edson. If allowed to move forward, this destructive bush-era plan will repeat this form of industrial logging across Oregon's remaining natural heritage. Find that on PortlandIndyMedia.org. And now, I am pleased to welcome Paul Zaremka to KBOO Radio. Good morning, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty well, thank you. You have written Hidden History, and the back cover says that you are a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo and general editor for Research in Political Economy since 1977, author of Toward a Theory of Economic Development, editor of Frontiers in Econometrics, and co-editor of Essays in Modern Capital Theory. And the compilation, Hidden History of 9/11, I picked it up last night at Powell's Books. I got the last copy, by the way. Attention, Powell's Books.
Okay.
Very interesting and useful, because this story, 9/11, continues to drive policy, is obviously accepted by President Obama's administration and Obama himself. And so it bears examination. I'd like to ask you first. The corporate media has treated many stories about 9/11 as rumors, even though there is hard information about them. So I'd like to ask you first about the insider trading story. Do you have detailed info on the so-called put options that were placed before the 9/11 towers went down? I mean, the New York towers went down.
Yes. I mean, that's economics is my specialty, so, of course, that would be the topic that I would be most likely to investigate about 9/11.
Good then, bullseye.
it'll take me a little, you know, a few minutes to describe what it is, because some people don't know what insider trading is. So let me just say that's taking advantage of knowledge about a future event before other people know about it, and making profits from that. So that's insider trading, and that can be done in various ways. But one way that became highly discussed about 9/11 was using put options. And put options is a ability to sell a stock at a certain price, like, let's say, $30 in the future, and let's say buy the stock the same day. So you buy the stock, you have a possibility of selling a stock at $30, let's say, a month from now, and you know that if you know that it's going to be, let's say, $20, then you're going to make a $10 profit.
One of those Byzantine little things about the stock market that's come out in the last several years.
Exactly. So what happened is that people in the financial markets learned that there was a lot of put option trading done on American Airlines and United Airlines, the two companies that, of course, had airlines that were used that were subject to the crashes in 9/11. There was a lot of put options done in the week before 9/11. And some people even refer to the fact that they were like 90 times the usual level of insider.
What's the approximate dollar amount?
Well, yeah, that's also very interesting, because some people were saying that if you count that and other things that were going on that day, that maybe there was billions of dollars that possibly were made that day with insider knowledge of the future event. My own calculations is that's an exaggeration. That may have gone up to 100 million or in that order of magnitude, but not billions of dollars. But nevertheless, that's still $100 million.
Yes, we're way above fancy new car material here.
Right. So what happens is that about 1 month after 9/11, there was in Barron's Financial Weekly and in some other financial outlets, there was discussions about this enormous level of put option trading in American Airlines and United Airlines stock. And so the question that was immediately raised was, and people put it as if, all we have to know is who made those trades, and then we'll know who did 9/11. And I think that they were thinking that it'll immediately point to Osama bin Laden. So they really were getting excited, and they in fact know that it's quite easy to find out who purchased those put options. It's really quite easy to find that out. I mean, you can't find it out, but I mean the government knows who it is. But that discussion fell off the map after about 1 month. I think what happened is that they realized, or they were told, or somebody, the word got out that the answer, that what you're going to find out is not what you want to, what you're going to expect to find out. You're not going to find out that it led to Osama bin Laden. And sort of the kibosh was put on further discussion of it. But since it went out, the 9/11 Commission report did have one sentence about it and then one long footnote about those put options, which are, I mean, I could discuss it, but I don't think it's worth that much discussion. But should I go on a little bit?
Yes, I'm actually interested because, it simply seems to indicate that someone knew in advance that the event was going to take place. David Ray Griffin wrote about this in his book, New Pearl Harbor Revisited, and I had him on KBOO also.
Yeah, what I want to say is that there have been two academic studies that have been done with data superior to the data that I have available. One was done by a Professor POTUS Mann from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and he published an article in the Journal of Business. The Journal of Business is a regular academic journal, peer-reviewed academic journal. It's not at all political, and he was able to get confidential data from the Chicago Board of Trade, which is the one that deals with these put option trades. And he then did some sophisticated econometric analysis of it. Econometrics has been one of my fields in economics.
Uh-huh.
And he did a relatively sophisticated analysis and found that, to make a long story short, there was 99% probability for one of those stocks it was insider trading, and for the other stock it was a bit less than that. But put together, it gives overwhelming evidence. Not 100% proof. It's a probability estimate.
Well, this is one of those issues. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so it's a very high probability that there was insider trading.
And as you say, it is possible to get the information, and yet it seems that nothing's been put forward except circular arguments. As David Ray Griffin wrote, the syllogism seems to go, number one, the attacks of 9/11 were planned and executed solely by Al-Qaeda. Number two, no other person or agency had any role in or even advanced knowledge of the attacks. Number three, the purchaser of the put options on United Airlines stock had no connection with Al-Qaeda. Four, the purchaser, therefore, could not have had any advanced knowledge of the attacks, which is not actually a syllogism, of course, but just circular logic saying, don't go there. And that's all you get if you try to find out about that. Well, thank you for bringing further light to that. What evidence is there?
Let me just add one thing. And there's professors at the University of Zurich who have done further study of it. It's not yet published, but they gave me permission to say that their results confirm what Professor Portman found out in the same direction, that there's a high probability of insider trading.
Oh, so this is about to come out in a publication in Switzerland.
Well, I don't know. They could send it anywhere to be published, but they are Swiss professors at Zurich.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Go ahead.
All right, changing the subject a little bit. What evidence is there that the alleged hijackers are still alive? This is another story that is treated as a mere rumor or poo-pooed by the corporate-owned media. It seems that there's a little squidginess around the details about who was on those planes and whether they still actually exist. And, I'll let you go on about that.
Okay. It's covered in the first chapter of the book by Jay Kolar. The book, The Hidden History of 9/11, of course, is an edited book, so I only have one chapter, the second chapter. So the first chapter has to do with the hijackers. And, I could go on quite a bit about this, but one thing I want to say from the very beginning is that if you read the 9/11 Commission report, they simply list the names of 19 hijackers, and there is absolutely, absolutely no proof that these individuals were even on the plane. I mean, they just took a list provided by the FBI, and then just expect you to believe that those are the people who were on the planes, and that's the end of the story.
Is that the basis of evidence? We know that these are 19 people, the 19 people who are involved because the FBI says so, and that's it?
Yeah, they don't even say it quite that way. They just take it as if it was a fact that these people were there. And yet the director of the FBI himself, in an interview not that long after 9/11, said, we don't have proof that these were the individuals on the plane because it could be stolen passports or double identities or whatever. I mean, he himself said that they don't have proof. And yet, when the 9/11 Commission report comes out, it doesn't query at all any evidence about these, with certain minor exceptions, but certainly not for the whole entire 19. And what Jay Kolar does...
That seems like a rather large whoops, since we're talking about $1 trillion later and a million dead people later.
Yep. It's outrageous. I mean, I really get angry about this. But it's even deeper than that, because... Jay Kolar's chapter, I mean, he finds the coverage in, like, for example, L.A. Times, BBC in England, The Independent, a Saudi newspaper. A number of outlets around the world have reported that 10 of the 19 alleged hijackers were alive after 9/11. Okay, that's what actually the question you asked me.
Yes.
So he finds, I mean, you can go to those publications. He provides the dates of the articles, and people stand up and say, basically, you know, you've just named me. It's clear that it's not a double identity because you're naming the city I live in, or you're and naming the school I'm at, or my job, or something like that. So it's more than just an issue of there could be two people with the same name. You're naming me, so I'm standing up, I'm alive. How can I be an alleged hijacker in those planes?
There's a person that's described as not just a description, but an entire history and dynamic. Jay Kolar writes on page 9 of your book, it was not possible, and I use this for an example, for a Hani Hanjour, meaning the hijacker, to transform himself from a gaunt, wiry build and receding hairline in the ATM photograph taken on September 5th, 2001, to a more muscular build with a full, almost chubby face and full head of black hair 6 days later in the Dulles Airport video. Just a little detail that kind of sticks
right in
your mind.
The reason why he mentions that is the Dulles Airport video is because there is a few cases where they do mention some evidence. And that's one of those cases, is Dulles Airport videos. However, the Dulles Airport security videos don't have any date or identification numbers on the videos themselves, so they could have been taken at any time and just, you know, thrown up as if they were taken on 9/11. Another video that is talked about sometimes is the video of Mohammed Atta and his alleged accomplice in Portland, Maine, before they flew to Boston, and they claim that that's a proper, I mean, that proves that they were there. But the problem is that even if they were there, it doesn't say that they were on the plane from Boston to Los Angeles. So it basically tells you nothing except that they were. I mean, that one does have the proper date on it, but it doesn't tell you anything more than that they were seemed to be at that airport in Portland on that day.
And it is peculiar, as your book, your compilation points out, that these modern airport 2001 videos should not have a date stamp, as all videos, as far as I know, in
right.
Major airports would have, so that they could be used as evidence, for example, in court.
Right, exactly.
Well, then...
And let me just go on a little bit more about the hijackers. The alleged pilot of flight United Airlines 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania, the alleged pilot of that was Mr. Jara, and there's a picture in the very beginning of the book of seven different photos, passport photos, those kinds of photos of Mr. Jara, and that have been released by almost in six out of seven cases by official agencies, government agencies somewhere, about the same individual, and there's at least two, probably three different individuals in those photos. In other words, Jara had a double. Jara had somebody around the world who was pretending to be him.
And this is pointing to the sort of government conspiracy that many people have speculated on, which I'll be asking you about, I suppose. You're listening to Press Watch on KVOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. And I have on the phone Paul Zarumka, author and compiler of The Hidden History of 9-1-1, published by Seven Stories Press, now available in that edition and updated. Well, so, Professor Zaremka, do you think hijackings then actually took place? And if not, how were the planes maneuvered?
That's a question that's a bit more complicated. Let me just say some things about that. First of all, if there were people who were doing the hijacking, it would not have required that every single hijacker knew what the program was. I mean, it only maybe needed one, okay, to do it. But step back a second. If you were trying to set up this whole operation, would you rely upon an individual human being getting in control of a cockpit of a plane and flying that plane accurately into a target? I mean, it's I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that I would not rely upon a human actor. I would do it electronically.
Well, I mean, it's human nature not to commit suicide. So
right.
I wouldn't count on that. I would, if I were doing it, I would tell the hijackers that we had a plan and they were going to be rich men and it would all work just fine. And then I'd make certain that those aircraft were sabotaged so that they would follow a beacon into their targets.
Right. So that's what I was going to lead to. When you actually think about it, the government has, and I don't blame them for this, they don't have evidence. They don't provide evidence that the planes were actually controlled by a pilot to the very last second. I mean, how would they have that evidence? I mean, they don't have a photograph of what's going on in the cockpit or something like that. So we don't really know what was happening in the last minutes of those planes. We only conjecture what it might have been. Now, one conjecture is that they had human beings, okay, they were doing it. But another conjecture, which you just mentioned and which I would think has actually superior possibility, is that the planes were somehow electronically programmed to fly on the flight paths that they went, or they were targeted or they were brought into a beam, like a landing beam that all of us experience when we fly these days. They were following a beam into the World Trade Center towers.
You know, it seems more likely to me, especially in light of the extreme maneuvers of the plane that allegedly hit the Pentagon, it seems that at the least it would require an expert in a G suit, not a novice, at the controls. And you have to wonder whether the G forces were too extreme even for that.
Yes. I mean, actually, some very experienced pilots said that actually for any of the operations, for either the towers or the Pentagon, to do Even experienced pilots would have had a great difficulty of doing that, let alone people who were quite poor pilots.
I guess for people who didn't grow up astro nerds, I should explain G-forces. I'm referring to the gravity-like momentum force, the G-force that occurs when you maneuver an object very hard. It's why you have to be strapped into your car to drive a sports car. It's why you have to be strapped in and have a special suit to keep you from blacking out to fly military aircraft.
Yes.
So, Paul Zaremka, why do you hate America? Okay, I'm kidding. just had to throw that in there. How could the towers collapse as rapidly as a ball dropped in a vacuum? Isn't that physically impossible? isn't there some theory being put forward that some bizarre quantum event? That's one of those words that's overused, like turbo or nuclear.
Well,
how can they collapse so quickly?
Okay, let me actually broaden the question a little bit.
All right.
Because I just gave a talk in Humboldt State College in California, and I asked the audience how many people knew that there were more than two towers that collapsed on that day. And it was clear that even though there's a relatively informed audience, I would say that about a third of the people did not know that a third tower collapsed.
And that's extreme, and that says something about a state of propaganda when people don't even know that a third tower collapsed, much less that it couldn't possibly have collapsed by itself for no reason, but go on.
Right. No. But this, actually, that's very interesting because I started looking at 9/11 around, why it really happened around January of 2002, and I published a book in October of 2002 in which I talked a bit about 9/11. And this is now 1 year, 13 months after the event, and I did not know that the third tower had collapsed. 13 months later, okay? It shows you how the media just ignored it. So anyway, that's why, you know, I'm as guilty as other people are of not knowing everything that happened.
Well, in the state of propaganda, it's understandable. But and yet, the claim, the official conspiracy theory is that those planes collapsed that rapidly. And actually, you know, you can certainly see them collapsing that rapidly into their own footprint. I mean, anyone who has seen demolitions of buildings can see that this is a demolition of a building, but it's not acceptable. It's not okay. There's much more to mind control than merely withdrawing the story. There's also creating the expectation that whatever you are told is going to be true, and whatever you see by your own eyes is not as true as what you've been told.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I would like to, you know, just throw in, as I frequently do when discussing this, that the law of conservation of momentum was not and could not possibly have been violated on that day or any day. It doesn't happen.
That's right, right. For your listeners, I think I should state exactly what that third building was. It's because many people probably don't know that.
Yes.
But it's the World Trade Center 7. What mostly is talked about is World Trade Center 1 and 2, which is the North and South Towers. But there was also a 47-story building, World Trade Center 7, which collapsed also at free fall speed. Free fall speed means at the same speed, it wasn't exactly, but almost at the same speed that Newton's or Galileo's laws of falling motion would dictate. And by the way, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which is investigating the cause of the collapse, is finally admitting that it was going at free fall or close to free fall speed.
And that will have to be finally. We've actually used up our time. Paul Zaremka, author of The Hidden History of 9/11, will be lecturing and signing his book on Saturday, March 14th at 2 p.m. That's this Saturday at Laughing Horse Books, pretty close to the studios here at KVU. Just off Burnside there at 12 Northeast 10th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. That's Saturday at 2 p.m. Laughing Horse. Paul Zaremka, thank you very much for joining me on Press Watch on KBOL Portland.
Thank you very much.